Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Retro Computing Roundtable Podcast, show number 2. This is the show where enthusiasts, collectors, educators, authors, bloggers, and podcasters of computer history get together and talk about news concerning our hobby. Plus, how recent tech news relates to our computing past, and even a few eBay auctions. I'm your host, David Grillish of ClassicComputing.com, where I blog and produce two other podcasts, the Classic Computing Show video podcast and Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. I'm broadcasting from the Atlanta area, Johns Creek, Georgia. On today's show, we are joined by another group of accomplished individuals. First, there's Evan Koblentz from Wall, New Jersey. He's the founder and president of the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists, or MARCH, and he's also the organizer of the Vintage Computer Festival East. Hey, Evan.
Hello.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm pretty tired, but I'm okay, thanks.
And you're used to public speaking, I know, but have you ever been on a podcast or like radio show, that kind of thing?
Yes, twice. I was on RetroBits talking VCF last year, and I was on the 2600 radio show a couple years ago.
Okay, yeah, I do remember you being on RetroBits now. He's had so many shows, you start forgetting, you know. I know that you were involved in the very first Vintage Computer Festival East, and that was 2001, I think, wasn't it? 2000?
No, I got involved with the second one in Boston in 2004.
Okay, so you weren't at that first one.
No, that was before I was even in the hobby.
Okay, so how did you get in the hobby? Or tell us a little something about your history with computer history.
I got in the hobby by accident. I'm more of a computer historian. And as a subset of being a historian, I started collecting some of the devices I was studying and found myself became a collector inadvertently. And one of the first people I met was Salam Ismail, who referred me to the Vintage Computer Festival, which at the time was just coming to Boston where I lived.
He had already planned on moving it from no, that's where it was, wasn't it? That's where it was originally.
Right, that's correct. And then when I moved down back to New Jersey, where I'm from, in 2005, and for March, we sort of got the rights to VCF East to do it there.
Okay. I was going to ask, too. So you started March there afterward.
Correct.
Okay. So our next panelist today is John Leake, and he's from Crestview, Florida. He's a co-host of the Retro MacCast podcast. Hey, John.
Good morning.
So you've been doing that show, you and James, for, let me guess, 2007 early sometime? Maybe earlier than that?
No, I don't think earlier than that. I would actually have to look.
late 2006.
See, yeah, there you go.
Not too far after Earl Evans, I think.
It's kind of said Derek knows more about our show than James and I do. When we're not sure if we've covered something, we ask Derek. That's awesome.
Your biggest fan?
Stalker. I have you guys pooping in my car on a CD.
Look out your window.
John, have you ever been on any other podcast before?
I think we've been interviewed on one or two others, but I couldn't give you any details.
Mac Radio Cast episode 5.
That one, and maybe one other.
Tell me a little bit about, so when did you get involved in, when did you start caring about computer history? And I guess specifically Macs, at least is your first love, right?
Well, actually, my first love is the Apple II series, and I basically started collecting by just not getting rid of my old stuff. I still have my Apple IIe from high school, my Apple II GS that I bought brand
new. That's cheating.
But then I had a 6200, and that was my first Mac, and there was a bank near us that was getting rid of all their old stuff for free. Yeah. And so I ended up with a Color Classic and a Mac Plus, and that's what really kind of started me on the whole collecting.
I can't believe you took that junk.
I know.
That was clearly trash they were getting rid of.
Oh my gosh. Doorstops and barrier reef material. That's
My second Color Mac. My first Power Mac was also a Performa 6200, the Rode Apple award-winning. You know what that machine was? Is that getting a little techie here? Because I was a Mac repair person. So basically, they took the 630, you know, which was a 040 machine, and they essentially stuck a Power PC in it. So, you know, that's why it was kind of slow. It just wasn't really optimized.
They kept all
the buses from the 040 logic board, so everything was running at half speed, if not quarter.
Yeah, you could take a a 6200, 6300, one of those logic boards, and you could slide it into a 630 case, and voila, it worked. It wasn't until the 6360 where they actually changed it, where then it had a PCI bus. But anyway, enough of that.
6360, which was still painfully slow.
So, hey, Derek. So this is Derek Warren, and he's calling from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Good to be here.
Thank you. And you're the host of the Mac Folklore Radio podcast and fill-in co-host for John on the Retro MacCast podcast.
Yes, that's me. And Mac Folklore Radio is still missing in action. I'm actually in the middle of moving again, so it's going to be a few more months.
Okay. The great thing about history like that is you can keep listening to it and it doesn't get old.
People keep saying that to me, and it's starting to become a trigger for guilt. So I'll just quietly say, yes, it is.
You know, Derek, also in your series, let me think here. Isn't it on your podcast where you also have, you have the thing about the Claris Works history?
Oh, that's right. I didn't research that myself. It was actually written by one of the Claris Works developers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I especially really like that one. I was a long-time Claris Works user. Now, when did you get into, what made you interested in the Mac's history or getting historical about it or collecting or anything?
I think just being curious about system internals. I remember, I think when I was 4 or 5, I saw my very first video game system, and it was a Famicom. Mm. You know, these people that were babysitting me. And one day, a Famicom disk system showed up. And I was way more interested in the disk system than any of the video games. So I guess that's when I learned early on, system internals really got me. And when I was a kid, we had an Apple II, we had a C64, we had an 8086 clone, we had a Mac SE.
Wow.
And just absorbing all the details about what you could do and how things worked just got me into it.
Sounds like my house now. What do you mean? You used to.
Well, these machines are long gone, but dove in. I guess when things went full circle is I got into the Atari ST scene in the late 90s, and that got me into the Amiga scene as well. I used to write tracker music, and now I'm exploring other stuff like running OpenStep on my MacBook Pro and exploring the world of the obscure, never heard of in North America, BBC Micro.
I've heard of it.
Good.
I've heard of it.
Okay, great.
Nice to have you on the show.
Well, great to be here.
And thanks to all you guys for being involved. I just want to mention about the Atari ST is... you know, the theme song I have for this show was written by a guy named John X, who was very gracious to allow me to use it. And so I had an exchange with him by email. And so he got started in music production on an Atari 520 ST, is what he told me.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. I guess I tend to think of Macs as being more along that line than Amiga for video. But yeah, the Atari 520, the Jackintosh, right?
Oh, this is the thing that gets me about music production and retro computing. People who had Amiga said, Amiga was a multimedia machine, but it didn't have built-in MIDI ports.
Mm.
And the Atari had built-in MIDI ports, so that made it the music machine in some people's minds. And then the Mac was the creative machine for everybody. And then it depends on who you're talking to and what time of day it is, really.
Right. The Atari was actually the bargain, too, out of all of them.
Oh, for sure.
So now let's get to our first item. So the first item here in our news section is that Windows 1.0 turned 25 this past week.
And they're still waiting for it to boot.
And actually, that was, according to the article here at Network World, so that was still 2 years after its announcement.
And it was a very interesting article. I did not realize that it wasn't until Windows 3 that they got rid of, you know, the user seeing a command line that Windows 1 and 2, you still had to know a lot about, the command versus just a GUI.
And that's when things were working well. I was reading a Slashdot commentary on this article, and somebody pointed out that there was a marketing kit given out at the launch of Windows 1.0. Again, this was 2 years prior to the actual release. It was a box with labeling that said, open this box to find out what's going to be the latest, hottest thing in computing. And there was a squeegee inside.
Oh.
So it was anticlimactic on two fronts. It was a squeegee, and it was 2 years late.
You needed to clean your Windows.
Right.
Or was it going to mess up your screen?
or at least clutter up your hard disk.
Does anyone have a copy of this? Or have you seen it?
No.
No?
Earliest Windows I came into contact with was 3.1, thankfully.
I have an original 95, so.
Well, I have an original compact portable, and so it has a hard card in it.
Oh.
And it boots DOS 3.3 and Windows 1.0. It doesn't boot Windows 1.0. I guess there's a way I can make it boot into it, but I just type in Win.
Wait a minute. There are 12-inch expansion slots in a compact portable.
Yeah.
Well, you type in Win to launch Windows. That's a bit of an oxymoron.
All righty. So we'll move on. Let's see. I know with Windows 3 was 1990, but then there was Windows, I think 2, and then 286, 386, if I'm not mistaken, and then Windows 3.
Oh yeah.
And then it wasn't really till Windows 3.1, I think, that it took off and dominated.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of system internals and architecture, the 386, I didn't realize was such a milestone in x86 development, not only in terms of performance, but bringing things like the PMMU and all these other things that I don't really understand on board. There's a video all about how it was a big business success as well, because it was single-sourced initially over at the Computer History Museum's YouTube channel. If you Google the business case for the 8386, there's a great video about Intel's history and how they were kind of faltering a bit and how the 386 saved them.
I'll make sure to add that to the show notes. See business case for the 386. Coincidentally, too, since you mentioned the 386, I mentioned the Compaq. Compaq was the first, as far as I know, major producer of the Mecha 386. So they beat IBM out on that in that area as well.
And that right there is where IBM lost control of the PC market, so they say.
But they came back real big with the PS2. Don't forget, they completely shut down the whole clone market. That's
right.
A joke.
Temporarily, anyway.
Yeah, I'm just drowning in microchannel architecture expansion cards here in my closet.
All right, let's move on to the next item, which is that Christie's, which is an auction house in England, right? It is going to be auctioning off an Apple I computer. And so, Evan, I know you've looked into this, so tell us more about that.
It isn't the first time we're doing an Apple I, but in 2005, they did a similar auction of computer history. And they made a big fuss how it was the first time it was ever being done bought by an organization such as theirs. Back then, there was just as much of a controversy over prices as there is today. And the big winner back in 2005 was Mitch Kapoor of Lotus fame. And he won it? He won the majority of the high-priced items in 2005. And I believe he loaned or donated the majority of it to the Computer History Museum at the time. So that was good because all the good stuff did not end up in private hands. Now, I was looking on eBay last night, and I figured the ridiculous price for the Apple, actually, the price for Apple One, they're starting their bid, if I understand it correctly, at $160,000.
Yeah, 100,000 pounds is what they say they expect to fetch between that.
Right. So I believe that was listed as a low price. So
yes.
You guys know, and I bet most of your listeners know, David, typical price in the U.S. for an Apple One is $15,000 to $25,000.
Yeah.
Now, if I were appraising this particular Apple One, I would say, well, on one hand, it's got the signed Jobs note and it's got the manuals in a box. Mm-hmm. So that's, ups the price a little bit. On the other hand, it's a high serial number. It's in unknown operational condition. And it seems to have some non-original parts. According to Christie's, the 6502 chip is stamped 8145. Which means it was made in the 45th week of 1981. So it's still an original 6502 chip. It's probably no different than a 75 model, but it's like putting a 1981 engine block in a 1975 car.
Right, it's just not original any longer.
Yeah, and so you're getting, again, a high serial number, in computer of unknown, operational condition, thank you. The non-original chip. And it was one other thing, I forget what it was, but there was another knock on it. So those things combined balance off the fact that it has the original box and then signed note. I put it squarely in the middle of the price range. In the last few years, most of the Apple ones have been on the lower half of the price range because of the economy. So I'd say this is worth no more than $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
where they got 160 from. I understand if it's Christie's and they have a different clientele who doesn't follow, you know, the popular computer history forums. I understand this. Those people are probably rich art dealers, not computer hobbyists. So even if they double the price, you know, or the $50,000, fine. But 160?
It's 8 times the price because it's an 8-bit microcomputer.
I was looking on eBay last night, and I found some other things that I'll mention briefly that are almost or even more egregious. There's somebody, a seller called Sales PC Plus, selling a K-Pro 2 for $35,000. Now, that one should list it in the past. They claim it's serial number 3, but even if that were true, so what? You know, maybe it's worth, you know, a 10% premium versus the usual K-Pro price. There's someone, a seller called BCRYE 2010, selling a TI-99/4A for $20,000. There's a couple more I want to mention.
Go ahead. There's crazy stuff out there.
Seller Miller 1987, selling a C64 for $8,000. Seller 10 Stuffmart, selling an IBM 5155, which is their luggable, for $3,000. And then a few others. There's a 2GS for $2,000, an Apple III for $1,200, a Scion 2 for $1,200. Here's the best one of all. There is a stuffed toy raccoon, which somebody listed under Vintage Computing because it allegedly came from some random computer store called PC Connection in the early 80s for $1,000. It's a stuffed toy animal.
ClassicComputing.com holds no responsibility for the opinions expressed on this program.
Actually, PC Connection and Mac Connection were big distributors back in the day, but...
But is there a stuffed toy raccoon you got with your software worth $1,000?
Yeah.
Whatever Christie's is drinking and or smoking, apparently there's a larger batch out there somewhere to be had.
About the Apple One, John, didn't you guys cover... Wasn't there a recent Apple One auction the last couple of months? Or anybody? I remember...
Well, there was one
eBay.
Yeah, there was one covered on the Retro Maccast about 2 months back.
Okay.
And that went for, 20, 25?
Yeah, I mean,
there was also one a few weeks ago that was discussed in CC Talk that somebody, I don't know if they were either unaware or manipulative, but somebody was selling an Optronics kit as an original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you have to be very careful with all those kits out nowadays that you are
Vince Briels is labeled Briel Computing on the motherboard. But the Optronics is very realistic. And Steven, whatever his name is, you know, he'll tell you, but customers don't know.
Right, right.
And I agree with what you're saying, Evan. Yeah, there's some other things about this auction that perhaps you could argue balance out some of the inequities of the, you know, like the chip and stuff. It's got the cassette interface, you know, the letter. But no matter what this thing, I mean, it's an Apple One, so right there it's worth... I would say $15,000-$20,000. So Maybe it's arguably worth a little bit more because of the venue it's being auctioned in. But no way can I see it being worth more than $25,000.
But also, how much do you think them doing a price like that is to get people going, this thing is selling, you know, getting basically
hype?
Free.
Yeah, well, yeah, but that yeah, happens on eBay. Is that absolutely. And also, especially the eBay phenomenon where, you know, all it takes is one fool to ask a high price and one bigger fool to pay it. And the next time it comes around, someone says, oh, well, look what the last one sold for.
Exactly.
That was an anomaly.
Yeah. And especially with an item like this.
Lesson here is stick to emulators.
Pretty much.
Well, my major concern, I mean, I'm not complaining because this is good for all of us, at least on the sell side, right? All it's going to take is one rich Saudi prince who doesn't know the difference to pay the price, and it just blows up.
And the one thing, again, that makes this more unique about especially jacking the price up is that they're so rare, and there's only so many of them, approximately 200, I guess, is the official opinion on that. I don't know. I think supposedly there's even less than that. Because some of them...
200 made.
Yeah, because some were turned back into Apple, right? And they... For like an upgrade.
Now, I know you guys are the Apple guys. I don't want to step on your toes, but as I understand it, there's probably around 50 to 75 still out there.
Yeah, because there was a turn-in. You could turn in your Apple One for a huge discount when the Apple II came out.
Yeah.
So that Steve Jobs could grind it up and take your money from you.
I hate these things.
Well, nobody knew what it was going to be worth. So.
But what I noticed happens on eBay in other situations, though, you know, as an eBay buyer or bidder or whatever, is something comes out and it's reasonably rare. It doesn't come up very often, and it goes for a really good price. So you know what? If you just sit back and keep looking, all of a sudden three or four come out of the closet, mm-hmm. and these people are expecting to get the same amount of money, and they usually get half, you know, depending. Was something that Derek said kind of rolls us into the next topic, which is reproduction kits.
Yeah, reproductive kits.
Totally different podcast. We're all only computer geeks here, so, but we're not that kind of podcast. It's the Big Bang Theory.
So I guess Vince Briel, he is kind of, and Evan, you know him pretty well, and yeah. I've met him a few times, but he's kind of the king of the reproduction repro kits.
He does have a few children. He's a very nice wife. So, you know, Vince is certainly the king of that field, but he has plenty of competition.
Yeah.
Rich Cinney, who's also in my group, does an Altair, like an Altair PC kind of kit.
Yeah, and please speak to, is that like, that's currently available? Because I wasn't sure about a lot of these other kits.
It's either currently available or he's been working on it. I forget exact status. Now, before Vince came along, it was the Optronics guy, Steven something or another.
Mm-hmm.
Steven, I apologize, I forget your last name. And also before Vince, there was Bob Armstrong doing the SBC, the PDP-8 single board kit.
Right, right.
Also, have you guys run across the direct-to-TV Commodore 64? It was like a joystick.
I have one.
Yes.
Sprung out of the Commodore C1 reconfigurable computer by Jerry Ellsworth.
Right. Well, I think it's awesome what the people have done with that, where they've taken this single thing and they're adding keyboards, they're adding disk drives and everything all to this little, you know, made to hook up to your TV kit.
Now, by the way, I happen to have one of those right here on my desk.
Oh, awesome.
Last, you know, when I was last couple of days when I was looking at David's agenda here, I see one of the items we're getting to very soon is this Mini MIG, which is sounds like a similar idea for the Amiga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if the people who did that weren't aware of, or for some reason chose not to just do it for that other kit instead.
There was a big reason. The Commodore C1, which is sort of the parent project that spawned the C64 DTV. The
Commodore C1, Jerry Ellsworth,
more,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Commodore C1. I don't know that Jerry is still involved in the C1 project, but it's more or less a hardware developer's kit. Mm-hmm. I actually went crazy. Went looking to buy a Commodore C1, but it's really an FPGA development environment for computer cores,
right,
more than anything,
right,
else. Whereas the Mini MIG and the C64 DTV are packaged products that are ready to go for mere mortals, as Steve Jobs would say.
Oh, I see.
But they have they've got an Amstrad CPC core for the C1, they've got an Amiga core, they've got a C64, mm-hmm. C128, and VIC-20 cores, yeah, for the C1. It's crazy.
I believe, for any listeners out there, a little plug for Jerry, her main gig now is fatmanandcircuitgirl.com, which is a weekly web hacking show.
Oh, cool.
And it's so cool. Make sure you check out, if nothing else, the floppy drive analog delay unit.
Okay, I'll put that all in the show notes. Fat Man and Circuit Girl?
Yes, that's right. They've blown up a talking Furby. Jerry made a Nintendo in her purse.
I saw that.
All kinds of wild, wild things.
Speaking of that, it's the DTV, right? Isn't that what it's called, the joystick?
I have
one. There was also a, I think it was based on her work on the same circuit board or whatever. There was a Radio Shack Hummer, like a Hummer game.
Well, it's all the same thing. It's,
yeah, and then,
I don't want to insult Jerry, but it's basically different shapes, you know,
mm-hmm.
For the same basic. I mean, it's different, you know, different toys on the outside, but inside are all still Commodore 64s. And that's my favorite thing about the DTV is, you know, you can hack in a keyboard and a disk drive if you want, your joystick. And, of course, she effectively tricked the manufacturing company to let her do that.
Yeah, and people buy those and hack them.
Yes.
Well, just to mention on our list here, and you guys tell me, well, first let's say, who has what? Does anybody own any of this stuff? So like Vince,
I just have the original DTV. Oh, you mean Vince's stuff?
Any of these repro kits?
Yeah. Well, I was one of the first people to build a replica one. I did a review on it for my old newsletter.
Okay.
And if you pick up Tom Owad's book that he wrote about Apple One, you know, recreation,
mm-hmm.
I think there's like one page in there about me.
Apple
at the time, I built it in 2005 when my soldering skills were pretty rudimentary. And I concluded, if I can build this, anyone can.
Okay. And then Vince also makes a MicroKim, and I have one of those unbuilt. I need to build it. I have a replica one that I built at the Vintage Computer Festival 06, California. And then he recently came out, which I've mentioned in my other podcast, the Altair Micro, which I have one, and I need to build it. But anybody else, John or Derek, you guys own any repro kits?
I'm waiting for, and it's never going to happen, like an Apple IIe version of that. But obviously there's no way they're ever going to allow licensing on.
Why would you want that when you can get a real Apple IIe so easily?
Well,
hold on.
They gave away the Apple II schematics in the manual, so theoretically some FPGA wizard could build an FPGA core that gives you an Apple II and load it onto something like the C1. There's also a guy who's doing something called the he does all kinds of what would you call them? Custom chips that went into old stand-up arcade games. He's reverse engineering those and making FPGA-based replacements for obscure custom chips for old arcade games. Check out www.fpgaarcade.com, and he's got a similar project to the C1, where it's a reconfigurable computer. You know, you load in your ZX Spectrum core, you get a ZX Spectrum. He's got an AGA Amiga core coming up. So theoretically, this might be the successor to the Minimig. fpgaarcade.com. Not available for sale just yet, but in development.
But John,
and you were asking about it was the same reason that it's kind of cool to have the Commodore 64 version. Obviously, you can get Commodore 64s, pretty readily. I mean, same thing with the Apple IIe's, but I don't know. It's just kind of cool having fresh hardware you can mess around with, because the older hardware is getting old.
And that's the way I feel like my Altair 8800 Micro. I could eventually buy one, buy a real Altair and mess around with it, but it's getting more and more unlikely. I'm really excited to get it done, have the blinking lights, and the switches on it and mess around some. Hey, if you guys haven't looked, there's a few other things, the Minimig, there's this Hackvision kit, which is more of a gaming kit, but look at the bottom one, the 4-bit microcomputer kit. That's kind of interesting, a 4-bit microcomputer, but this is from the Maker Shed.
Oh, yeah.
I've been meaning to buy this one for a while, even though I have two unbuilt kits as it is.
Yeah. A couple other kits I kind of mentioned, forgot about. Periodically, there's somebody whose name I forget via eBay who does a Mark 8 reproduction kit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very cool.
And I think he stopped. I don't think he makes them anymore, but I'm not sure.
Well, we were lucky at our March Museum here in New Jersey. John Titus sent us the front panel from the reproduction kit that the kit maker gave to him. So we have that. We have the one that was given to John Titus, John gave to us. And there was also, there was another famous kit a couple years ago.
MicroKim. That's from Vince Briel. But there's also, when I went to the Vintage Computer Festival in 06, I built another, RCA Cosmac Elf kit.
Oh, right. Is that Bob Armstrong as well?
I think so, yeah. I only met him that one time, but yeah, I believe so. And I'm not sure if he's still making kits. I think I want to try to do an update about what's going on with these kits. That 4-bit microcomputer one is kind of interesting because it's sort of like the Kim or the Cosmic Elf with the little keypad and stuff. It's only $40. It's one of these Japanese Gaken kits. And they have a lot of interesting stuff. So check it out. All right, next we're going to move on to just something I want to mention, the Kansas Fest podcast that Ken Gagne introduced recently. I've listened to a few of them, and have any of you ever been to the Kansas Fest? anyone been to that before?
I have not, but I've always wanted to.
Same here.
Well, let's go. Let's go next year. I want to go.
An Apple II was the first computer I ever owned. I think it was my bar mitzvah present or something way back when. And I'd love to go. Just haven't had the opportunity. But I know Ken's a great guy. He puts on a hell of a show. Mm-hmm. And I've heard nothing but good things about it.
Well, Jason Scott, who we mentioned earlier, was the keynote speech giver at the last one. And so he's got his speech online here. So you can look at all this stuff on the website. You can subscribe to the podcast and pretty much be there virtually from all the different presentations and speeches.
And I believe the year before, they had someone not quite as famous as Jason, but his name was Wozniak something or another.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a reason to go, I think.
Yeah, he's some guy. He built like some kit computer or something, didn't he?
Yeah.
Someone out of his garage,
I heard he's a real jerk.
No, that was his buddy.
Wrong Steve, wrong Steve.
Waz, if you're listening to this, we love you. Please don't. We know we're kidding.
So the next Kansas Fest is 8 months and 6 days away, because it's right there on the website. It's July 19th to July 24th. I'm really hoping to go. I was never a huge Apple II fan, but the first computer I ever learned on and programmed on was an Apple II Plus.
Actually, the first computer I programmed on was in about third or fourth grade. We did Logo on VIC-20s.
Ah.
But then in middle school, we did, I would think I was the first, you know, class in my town to go to middle school, not junior high. And of course, we started doing AppleSoft Basic, and that's when I had a home.
Ooh. I can date you then.
Yeah. Not literally.
I think I know the time
not
frame.
Not to say they're wrong with that.
Big Bang Theory.
Of them changing the junior high to middle school. So I'm gonna. So what was that? That's probably around mid-70s sometime.
In my town, it was actually more like mid-80s.
Oh, okay.
For us, my first year of high school was 1980, and when I started school there, they had one computer. It was a Trash 80.
Mm-hmm. Oh, why'd you have... No, you didn't.
What?
What was that?
Isn't that what the name of it
is? I guess. I guess it's a loving tribute sort of name now.
The thing that I always laugh about is, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You know, myself and you know, I only had an Apple II because my mom worked for the Board of Ed. She got a big school discount, and half the kids in my school had Apple IIs, half the kids had Commodore 64s, and nothing but Flame Wars. And we didn't know at the time it was all the same chip inside.
Yeah, the 6502.
We didn't know.
Yeah. This could really start.
But it was nice. By the time I left high school in 84, we had a computer lab with like 30 Apple IIes in it. So quite a change in 4 years.
I won't tell you when I went to high school because I'll get flamed.
Actually, was it 64 or 6502 or was it a later version?
It was a 6510, actually, which was a 6502.
Yeah, I was thinking that's not right. Okay.
I think it had like an ACIA or something on ship.
Right, yeah. I think because that was 82, it wouldn't have been a 6502 anymore. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting, right, is Commodore bought MOS technology. So in other words, they were furnishing the processor to their competitor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of – wasn't Apple kind of kicking their butt around with the Apple II for the most part?
Well, even if they were, if you've read On the Edge, the fantastic Rise and Fall of Commodore by – Brian, forgotten his last name.
Book.ca. Yeah.
Commodore had a huge advantage and they were completely integrated. So what they lost in giving chips to their competitors, they made up in having super low cost parts in house.
Okay.
Right. That would be Brian Bagnall, BAGNALL.
Thank you, Brian Bagnall.
My shelf. Yeah.
I have it too. It's a great book.
Second edition of the book.
So moving on, let's see, I think we have enough time, we'll cover one more topic here, and then we'll move on to the eBay auctions. So this is a website that I found out about recently. If any of you guys check this out, it's called topdocumentaryfilms.com. I'm amazed at what's on there, and one of my all-time favorite documentaries is on there, The Machine That Changed the World, from 1991, I think, 1992. And if you guys or anybody else out there have not seen this, it's just fantastic. I mean, it's history, so it doesn't matter that it's an 18-year-old documentary. It's just so well done. It just has
Can you actually watch the documentaries on a site?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, and it's just
they have permission to do that.
If they don't, somebody who figured out that you can't buy The Machine That Changed the World on videotape or DVD, digitized a somewhat marginal VHS copy, and put it up on
It's available other places.
Legal torrent sites that we won't tell you about. I went to buy Nerds 2.0.1 on DVD, found out that you couldn't, wrote Bob Cringely, didn't get an answer, so I bought it on tape, and I put it on DVD for myself.
And you can watch The Machine That Changed the World, Triumph of the Nerds, Nerds 2.0, those are both the Bob Cringely ones, Robert X. Cringely, Video Game Invasion's another one, also Revolution OS, which is a history about Linux. There's a few other, you know, go under the category of technology, and there's how many of these say they have on here now? 1,300 documentaries? I mean, it's crazy. There's all kinds of stuff. I love documentaries, so there's just lots of good stuff. I hope it lasts.
Nerds 2.0.1, so unless you buy it secondhand on VHS, so check it out.
I have those on VHS. Actually, here's Triumph of the Nerds right here. You guys big fans of that documentary?
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen it.
Oh, you've never seen it?
I think I know what I'm doing later today.
Oh, yeah, you got to check it out.
You haven't
I think
seen
I saw
it,
it a long time ago. I don't remember.
If I'm not mistaken, it aired, I'm going to say it aired on TV, PBS, like 1996. I think it was made in 95.
Machine That Changed the World was PBS Summer 93.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and The Machine That Changed the World. I had a guy had recorded off PBS that I met years ago, you know, in computer history circles, and he made me a copy. And then I actually, over the years, had a couple of people looking for it, and I helped them out by making a copy of my copy. Even actually an Apple employee actually wanted a copy really bad, and I made him a copy, and he sent me, like, some Apple knickknacks from the company store and stuff to thank me. Wow. So it was very hard to get a hold of for a long time.
Yeah, The Machine That Changed the World and Triumph of the Nerds both have interviews with Steve Jobs mm-hmm. In the twilight years of Next.
The Triumph of the Nerds has that classic sort of interview with Steve Jobs where he talks about, you know, I made a mistake, I hired the wrong guy, or something like that, talking about John Sculley. Oh, and he's talking about Bill Gates not having any taste.
Yeah. You see, he's in a Next conference room because it's black, dark, very stylish. And in the background, there's a TV showing, I think it's www.next.com, where they're advertising web objects, mm-hmm. if you look closely.
I just hope that in 20 years from now, nobody sees Pirates of Silicon Valley and think that's a documentary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because that hasn't come up in a while. Yeah, there's a number of inaccuracies in there.
There was, you know, there's that famous picture of Bill Gates on the cover of Teen Beat magazine.
Is there?
Draped across the desk.
I think I see that. Yes, yeah. And on his desk is a Macintosh.
Yeah, because they were the biggest application developer next to Adobe for the longest time. Probably still are.
Oh yeah, if anyone doesn't know that, it's hysterical. There's a famous picture you can easily Google.
Oh, I'll check it out.
Very young Bill Gates on the cover of Teen Beat magazine.
That's
very fun stuff.
I'll get that. See, Bill
Gates. I didn't know he was actually on the cover. I mean, I got that in an email 10 years ago. I thought it was being sarcastic.
I don't know, but it's not fake. It's not Photoshopped. It's real.
Derek, you never noticed how dreamy Bill Gates is?
I don't get it, because even if he was a billionaire back then, why would they have thought he was someone for 30-year-olds to also look up to? I don't get that.
It's the seduction of money.
Yeah, but there's
it was Teen Beat, the corporate edition.
But Pirates of Silicon Valley is well worth watching, but absolutely, it's in no way accurate history. For instance,
it's entertaining movie, but lots of movies that are not true entertaining.
Like in the movie, they are depicted Bill and
Steve Ballmer.
The other guy, Paul. I think it's Paul and maybe it's either Steve and Bill or Paul and Bill, and they fly to IBM's headquarters, and that's not how it happened. But you know, the movie does have a real impact about the whole thing with Bill Gates showing up on the screen at Macworld 1997. You know, and
he's like Big Brother overlorded.
Yeah. He's the real bad guy, not IBM.
one of my favorite things that came out of the whole thing was the one of the keynotes shortly after that, where they had Noah Wiley come out mm-hmm. as Steve Jobs on stage before
Macworld
Steve Jobs.
New York 2000.
Yep, I remember that.
You know that. So yeah, I thought quite funny.
And he did a good Steve Jobs, I think. I mean, I think both of the actors did a good job, but you know, in some respects, they almost made I'd almost argue they made Bill Gates more sympathetic. They almost kind of made Bill Gates more human, even though you saw some kind of bad stuff about the guy. But Steve Jobs is like, you know, maniacal, sort of no heart. I mean, just kind of came off kind of bad, I think. Anybody agree? Disagree?
Yeah, there was kind of a pantomime element to it that I didn't like, and it was sort of reversed. It was a bit odd to watch mm-hmm. it. And have you guys seen the UK equivalent of Pirates of Silicon Valley?
Yes, Sir Clive?
Clive Sinclair and Acorn Computer.
Mm-hmm.
Micromen aired October of last year on the BBC. And again, you can't buy it on DVD, even though I'm sure literally dozens of retro computer collectors would want to. You can get it on perfectly legal torrent sites that we can't tell you about. And it's a great watch. Great viewing.
Did it air in Canada?
No way. I had to obtain it through other channels, as it were.
Me too. Do you think it'd be legal if I mentioned the website forum I found out about it? Maybe not. I don't know.
Oh, along those lines, I actually found another legal torrent site with most of the BBC Computer Literacy Project on it. So making the most of the micro and the computer program. And for those of you that don't want to delve into torrents, there's a whole bunch of Micro Live on Google Video, but that's getting really obscure now, so I'll shut up.
Plus on archive.org, you can watch all the great PBS
shows. Oh, Computer Chronicles.
Yeah, Computer Chronicles is fantastic. So I guess we're going to move into eBay auctions. And first, I'm going to just quickly go over the auctions from last time, which there were a lot more than there will be this time, because for now on it's just going to be four. But let's see, real quick. The IBM Personal Computer 5150 and keyboard, so it sold for $49. So I think that was maybe its, yeah, one bid. So $49. The vintage CompuGraphic Corporation computer boards, three bids, sold for $13.50. Those two were the ones that Bill Degnan, you know, spoke about. And then, see, this is Earl Evans. He did the Commodore CBM Super Pet 9000 rare vintage computer. 21 bids, sold for $320. Wow. There's been a couple more of those on, too. Yeah, these two, I think, are Carrington's. So the Vintage Digital Deck Computer Lab H500 Logic Trainer, it was a buy-it-now, so it sold for its $149.98. Seems a little high, actually, but it sold for it. And then the Heathkit Microprocessor Trainer 3700 and ETW 3567, it sold for $149.99, which is, it says one offer, so maybe it was sold for a little less than its original buy-it-now, unsure. But everyone, you can go to last show notes, and you can click over to these and look at them. And there's two more. These are the two I brought up. Was a vintage Altair 8800 computer and two CI-S100 readers EUC. 26 bids, sold for $2,500. Wow, what do you think of that? That seems a little high, doesn't it?
Oh, that's not that bad. $2,800?
$2,500. No, not bad.
Not that bad a price.
No. I guess I'm surprised that quite that high, but yeah.
No, I think M-size out there is in decent condition, go for around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see, the last one was look at this, it didn't sell. An ISC Systems Corporation S100 bus computer model 0120. It was at $150, no bids. Let me see if he relisted it. Because that'd be actually a cheap, I don't see it listed again, unless maybe it was listed again and then sold.
It might have been just a chassis.
Yeah, you might be right. I tend to think it actually had all its cards and all that stuff, though.
Oh,
well, here
right.
We go. See full description for that one. Yeah. No, it was a full system.
In that case, that's very odd. That would have been a real bargain.
Yeah, it was a real plain Jane-looking machine, but it had a disk drive built in. You know, no panel switches or anything, just on and off. But it was fully, you know, had all the
there
boards
had, there
in
had
it.
To be some kind of catch, because that would have been a bargain. Someone would have scooped that right up. Or maybe they realized it was selling too low and pulled the auction.
Huh,
maybe they're sending it to Christie's.
That's what I'm doing next time. So let's go on to this show's auction. So you go ahead and go first, Evan.
Okay. Well, I know. Well, I shouldn't say I know. I'm speculating that only a small percentage of hobbyists are interested in real computer history. You know, I mean real. I don't mean to sound snobby about it, but serious history back to the 50s. However, this seems like a great bargain to me. I'm very tempted to buy this myself. Item number, where's the item number?
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay. 1961 Remington Rand UNIVAC History of Computers brochure for $35 or a buy it now of $50. You get a 12-page Remington Rand UNIVAC history brochure from 1961. That sounds like I'm sure it's, you know, Remington Rand's view of history, so it's not exactly objective, but it seems like a really neat thing to have. You know, might quite possibly learn a few things from it, and it seems like a pretty good price for that kind of item. And it's not, you know, I've never seen anything like it before, and I'm very tempted to buy it myself, but there's five days and 9 hours to go, so it sounds pretty interesting. It says here in the description, it covers the LARC computer, it covers magnetic storage drum memory, thin film memory, it covers some early airline reservation system, it talks about ENIAC, and it says it's in very good condition. Hmm. So it seems like a pretty nice little find.
Ashamed to admit, I didn't know LARC was a computer. I was a bit puzzled as to why LARC, with an exclamation point, was in the auction title, and I thought it might be a warning of some kind.
No, it's a computer.
And at least to me, because it's going to reflect shipping to me, but it says it's only $1.90 shipping, which, you know, obviously it's a small brochure, but that's, you know, hey, they're being fair about the shipping too, which is a plus.
Yeah. Well, earlier I mentioned the K-Pro that some fools trying to sell for $35,000 plus $1 shipping and handling.
The UNIVAC Lark, the Livermore Advanced Research Computer, was Remington Rand's first attempt at building a supercomputer. It was designed for multiprocessing with two CPUs called computers. Anyway, it was delivered to Livermore in June of 1960 per Wikipedia, the absolute authoritative source of all information in the world.
And in case anyone doesn't know, the quick lineage from UNIVAC. First, it was ENIAC at the University of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Malkley and Eckert split out and did Eckert-Malkley Computer Company,
right.
MCC. Their product was UNIVAC, and eventually the company took the UNIVAC name for itself. Remington Rand acquired UNIVAC. They merged with Sperry to become Sperry Rand, and then Sperry Rand merged with Burroughs to become Unisys, which still exists today.
Was so Remington had acquired Rand, is that right, too, at some earlier point? Or,
right, and they also acquired Engineering Research Associates, ERA, and they merged all those. They merged ERA and UNIVAC into the UNIVAC division of Remington Rand,
mm-hmm.
which became Sperry Rand, which became, with Burroughs, became Unisys, which is still around today.
And that was like early 80s when they became Unisys, sometime in there?
Oh, no, I believe that was in, Burroughs was still around well past the early 80s, right?
Oh, okay.
I have
and
to look it up.
Can somebody tell me if the Rand of Remington Rand is different from the Rand Corporation?
Yes.
Okay. I've always wondered.
Do you think the same person or family or the Rand name or whatever is the same Rand name or different Rand name? Like that person Rand maybe went on to start another corporation, or do you know anything about that?
Well, Mr. Rand had a good brand.
sorry. And then there was Paul Rand who designed the Next logo.
I really don't know.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think Rand Corporation just stands for something.
And it is a real nice piece of history. And you're right. A lot, I guess, like myself, I have I have some books. I have some things related to older computer history. But I guess I'll say a lot of us hobbyists or collectors, I guess we tend to collect more stuff of our time frame or whatever, which is personal computers. But I'm pretty fascinated by the old stuff. I have one piece of core memory from a UNIVAC, and which actually brings us to who is it that has the Well, John, that brings it to your eBay item.
Yeah, and same thing. I have no idea what it's from, but I have a piece of core memory also.
But the one you have on the eBay auction, that thing is beautiful.
This one is very beautiful. This is much nicer looking than what I've got. But for those of you who don't know, we're talking about the core memory. It's back before RAM chips. Your memory was these little metal
donuts. Yeah,
these magnetic donuts, and the wires running through them that could change polarity of the magnet, and that's how it would read and write depending on what polarity the magnet was. So obviously nobody has any computers in their houses that use these things, but it's just a nice little piece of history to kind of show how far we've come. I mean, looking at the one that's on this auction, it's a 6-inch by 6-inch square.
And that's very
six
large.
Inch by six is basically gives you 2K of memory, if I did my math correctly.
And it's is that the original frame? I wonder.
I think that's got to be the frame.
It looks like a frame. It looks like a piece of art just hanging there on the wall.
It does, but if you look at the close up, it does look like that's. That's the way it must have come when it was, it would have been.
Yeah, it looks like those are pins on the edges.
Mm-hmm. So,
and I think human beings actually sort of, for lack of a better term, loomed that thing together, didn't they? I guess they had some production.
It's pretty cool. And I like using mine. It's a nice conversation piece. You've got this weird thing hanging on your wall. So this is the cheapest one of these that I found. I found a couple others. Some of that were actually done up like art pieces that they wanted $300 for with basically a close-up picture and some information on it. This one's $85. This has 2 days, 6 hours to go, ending November 15th.
Yeah, no bids. And no, $110 buy it now.
Buy it now price, which that's starting – $85 is starting to get a little high as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we're not going to talk about cost per megabyte, but
but even if you don't get this, it's something to kind of keep an eye on eBay if you're wanting a little piece of old computer history that you could use as a display.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the term core still lives lives on in a lot of Unix systems. If you've ever been working on a flaky system or with a buggy program at the command line on a Unix system, and all of a sudden you get kicked out and your shell says core dumped, segmentation fault, that's a reference to core memory.
Wow, very good.
So I guess to copy the Retro Maccast a little bit, shh, don't tell James. What do you think, John? Think it'll sell? 110 is maybe a little pricey, I think. Even 85. But
85 is still again,
a little high.
A little but high, but
it is nice.
It is unique. I mean, not unique, but it's not something you see very often.
I would also add that core memory, while very neat and very historic, is not all that uncommon. It's mm-hmm. pretty easy to find. So
okay.
There's always usually some examples on eBay. So
yeah.
All right, good to know.
Constant stream.
I think it's a real toss-up whether it'll sell for even the starting bid. Obviously, see, if it's got 2 days left, it's been on here for at least, I'm guessing, because I don't know, but 4 or 5 days. But you know what? They might have done it as a 10-day auction, so this might have been on here for 8 days.
I would advise listeners that if this one goes above their comfort price range, wait. There'll be another one.
Just keep waiting. Okay, yeah. Good.
And then, Evan, just back to you real quick. So what do you think about your item? Think it'll sell? So it's got 5 days. I think this one probably was just listed.
Oh, I'm really tempted to buy it myself.
I think it'll sell. I think, you know, especially because of the cheap shipping.
I mean, I don't know if I want to spend $50 right now, but it's very tempting. So I think if I don't buy it, somebody will.
Yeah. I have to hope whoever does buy it is nice enough to scan it in to share.
Yeah.
That's almost one reason why I'm tempted to buy it myself. I just don't know if I want to spend $50 right now.
Does anybody know, just for a little bit of discussion real quick before we move on to the next auction, you know, in the evolution of computer memory or storage, and so Evan, you might be able to speak to this better, but before core memory, wasn't it like, speaking of UNIVAC, wasn't the earliest memory like called Mercury storage?
Mercury
and then, there were Mercury
lines.
Delay lines, yes.
And so then DRUM storage?
And then before that, I mean, the guys who did, you know, guys you talked about last week, the Atanasoff, they were doing magnetic drums.
Okay.
And of course, you know, I mean, 3M and IBM invented magnetic disk in 1950, I believe, or something like that. So, but yeah, Mercury delay lines, that's what ENIAC used.
Yeah. All right, so Derek, so we move on to you.
Yes, what we have here on eBay UK is a complete BBC Micro Model B system. I brought this up purely out of self-interest because I'm into the BBC Micro these days. Also because when I went looking for BBC Micros, I found almost none. Certainly none in America, and almost none even in the UK, even though apparently 1.5 million of them were manufactured in the 80s. This is a nice system. It's got a few upgrades, so it's not a pure Model B. It's got a ROM expansion and a double-density disk filing system, complete with printer and cassette recorder if you're a real masochist. And
it's nice.
It's a nice-looking system.
And just for us, you know, United States-centric jerks.
Speak for yourself, David.
I'm only kidding. But basically, so it's got six bids. It's at £1,050. So that's $16.90. So shipping to me anyway would be, it's saying £24.95. That's about $40 if I was to
actually,
buy
that's
it.
The big reason I haven't imported one yet is that not, well,
actually, $40.
That's pretty darn reasonable.
Yeah, that's pretty good, it sounds like to me. So maybe the person's being very, I don't know.
Well, it's not too far off from what some of the other systems have gone for, although this is more complete, but it's local pickup only on these things because they weighed a ton, you know, solid steel construction. And the power supply is 240 volt only.
I was going to say, not only the power supply, but what about the video? It's PAL video, isn't it? Well, no, it has a display. But so I could use this. If I was to buy it, I could get a transformer. So I could use it. But if you bought, like, the BBC Micro by itself, you would not be able to hook it up to an American television set. I mean, am I right?
As far as I know, yes, that's correct. But I still want to buy one anyways, because there has to be a way to use it.
And I don't think we're jerks, us Americans. I'm only kidding. I know I myself, I fall into the, you know, yeah, the whole world where it's only us in the United States and try to fight that. So, okay, so that's got a day and 2 hours left.
And if you're listening in the UK, pick up some nostalgia for £10.
You know what? I did get some nice feedback about the first show from a person in New Zealand. So now for my eBay auction. And so I found this. Yeah, I waited till last night to find one. I think we all kind of did, maybe.
Oh, this is pretty awesome.
So they'd be current. But this is a great find here.
Oh, yeah.
And pretty darn rare. So let me go to it. So this is an Apple IIe Swift card. Tested and works, a rare find, it says. It has a starting bid at $99.99. It has no bids on it. It's got over 6.5 days, 6 days, 7 hours left. Let's see. From a surplus place, it says. McLean Surplus. So this is a card that Jeff Raskin developed. And in fact, maybe one of you guys can speak more to it, but it allowed you, it was kind of a test or of a development platform, I guess, to develop the Canon Cat later on. After he left Apple, you know, kind of disgusted, I guess, because Steve Jobs had commandeered the Macintosh project, and a lot of his ideas that went into this card and went into the Canon Cat were things he intended to do with the Mac. So,
yeah, I'm not sure if it was a development platform so much as bringing the Canon Cat technology to a wider audience. I'm not sure which came first.
Oh, yeah, and you might be right. That. I kind of, I guess, assume this came first. See, this is 1985. It says copyright on the card. I had one of these.
I also love how it says patent applied for on there.
That's mm-hmm. Component side, patent applied for. I had one of these cards back in the mid-90s, and I played around with it just a little bit on an Apple IIe. I actually exchanged some email back in the day with Jeff Raskin when I was doing my newsletter. Yeah, I guess, and I don't know this authoritatively, but I assume this came first, and then the Canon Cat, because I think the Canon Cat was 1987, which I just recently got a Canon Cat 2 weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations. Oh. That's a great find.
Yeah,
thank you. From the Holy Grail.
From a guy locally here in the Atlanta area. And in fact, I'm going to be interviewing him in a couple of weeks, just a quick Skype interview, and then I'll post pictures and our interview up. The great thing about this gentleman is that he really used it. So he wasn't just another collector. He's somebody that he actually bought it, he said, at a service merchandise. So it was, it was reduced. And of course, I'm going to talk to him and get all the details. But I think he said it was like $200 or $300. So he got a good deal on it. But it's got the matching printer. And so he really used it to do some fourth programming and, used it in the way that Jeff Raskin intended it to be used. And so I think that especially mm-hmm. makes it nice to talk to somebody that can speak to that.
I was lucky enough to meet Jeff once in 2005, I believe, maybe 3, I forget which, right before he passed away. And I remember he was with his family. Okay, he was with his family. He was very busy. But I just had a moment to say, excuse me, Mr. Raskin, I just want to say hello and it's an honor to meet you and blah, blah. And he was very nice. He took time out of his family to talk to me and just tell me a story or two. And he's a very, very nice man. And he wrote a book, which is still in print, that I highly recommend reading, called The Humane Interface. Mm-hmm. Not The Human Interface, The Humane Interface, in which he dissects everything that's wrong with interfaces, including the Mac and the Cat and Cat. And rather than just saying, here's what's wrong, he suggests a better way. A lot of people, anyone could say here's what's wrong, but to suggest a better way takes real, real guts and real brains. So I highly recommend reading his book, The Humane Interface.
Hasn't his son kind of taken up that?
Well, I haven't heard, let's put it this way, I haven't heard much progress on that front.
Okay.
The Archie text editor was still in development up until a few years back, but Asa Raskin, at least, is working at Mozilla Labs and doing some cool extensions for Firefox. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. So this, to me, is I think this will easily sell, at least for the $100 starting bid. I just, for much, hopefully much more than that. Well, hopefully, I don't, I think it'll sell for more than $100. It all depends, I guess, on how important other people think it is. It's interesting, it's at a surplus place.
Yeah, and if you're planning on doing lots of word processing on your Apple II for the Retro Challenge 2011, might be a good buy.
When is that, by the way?
No idea, but the winter warm-up will be in January.
Okay. So there you go. And so we'll be able to follow those going forward. So
guys got Retro Challenge projects lined up?
I've tried, lamely a couple of years where but I didn't really do it. And I hope to really be serious and try to do something interesting.
We have a project within March. Our next VCF is Vintage Computer Festival East 7.0, mm-hmm. and that'll be May 14 and 15 next year at our museum in Wall, New Jersey. We have a group project that we're keeping a secret till we hope to unveil it then when it's ready.
Ooh.
Dun, dun,
yes.
Dun.
How about you, Derek?
I was hoping to do at least the winter warm-up by way of living a month at home and at work just on OpenStep.
Oh, wow.
But it's not going too well so far.
Actually,
I'll
give you guys one hint about our project. Last year, somebody made a Twitter client, I think for a C64 or something.
Mm-hmm. Or Apple II or both.
Yeah. It was really kind of a cheat because it went through a serial port on a PC, and we thought that was kind of cheating. So I'll probably say too much now, but let's just say we're going to raise the bar.
You're really going to have to raise the bar because Twitter now requires SSL and OAuth. So I want to see you do that crypto on a 1 megahertz 6502, Evan.
Okay. Well, I didn't know about
man.
The intent to raise the bar.
I'm sorry if I just destroyed it.
Well, yeah. Way to slap down.
Well, actually, what exists now is you can buy a – I don't know the details, but there is, the museum adjacent to ours at the InfoWave Science Center is an antique radio museum. And those guys got a PC interface and some sort of CDMA client to send text messages from a teletype machine.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Pretty neat stuff. That raises a bar.
Hey, one thing, change the topic just for a moment, though, before we wrap up. But, John, I know that you guys discussed your Banana 9000. I had actually had it on, like, the news, and then I thought, well, I won't do it as a news item. This is something I can bring up to you just during our introduction. Of course, I forgot.
Oh,
but,
yeah. Well,
you got some fame for that, right?
The biggest thing was Berkeley Breath had actually linked to my blog about it on his Facebook page.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I'm flying high on that.
As in the guy who did Opus?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you got to look at his Banana 9000 he made, and it's really, really well done.
It's actually the 6000.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I saying it wrong?
Well, it's because the Cult of Mackie actually called it Banana 5000, but it's basically referenced once as the Banana 9000, the rest of the time is the Banana 6000.
Okay.
Do you remember Bloom County?
I love Bloom County.
Okay. Do you remember Oliver Wendell Jones?
Of course.
His computer, yeah.
His computer with the feet.
That was called the Banana 9000.
That's the 6000. That's the Banana Junior. Yeah.
Wow, okay. I didn't know that.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And I retrofitted a Mac Mini into a Mac Plus with an LCD screen, and I did the legs and everything. So
that's great. In fact, I recently traded a stuffed Linux Penguin Tux for a stuffed Opus.
Hey, all right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really it's amazingly well done. The attention, the detail that John did on it. I think the only knock you've received, John, right, is some people have commented about the insides. I guess
it is very, very bad. I got tired of shortening the cables after a while. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is taking forever. So it looks like the Flying Spaghetti Monster threw up a Radio Shack inside the box.
A church is a Flying Spaghetti Monster. Yes.
Now, I know a few people have asked. I can't remember the answers. Would the new Mac Mini with the built-in power supply have worked? If not,
yeah, well, the way I've got all the cables and everything in there, I can pretty much plug anything that will fit in there. So, but that now you're talking money. I was able to get a used
G4
Mini a lot cheaper than I would be able to get.
See, I would put a replica one in there.
Yeah. What about the heat?
I bought one of those little laptop pads with the two fans, and mm-hmm. you know, just get the power off a USB port. That's in the very bottom of there, so it's constantly pulling air, fresh air in. So far, I haven't had an overheating issue at all, and I've used it for hours on end. I've got it in my computer room. It's my multimedia system. So.
That has, if you do go to Kansas Fest or any other computer show, you know that you have to bring that. I mean,
I will keep that in mind.
I'll slam the door in your face. You show up without it.
Kansas Fest is an Apple II show.
Yeah, well, they kind of cross over in the Mac.
Besides, you don't want airport security looking at the insides of that thing.
Oh,
oh my gosh, yeah.
Oh, man,
well, I think I'd probably drive.
Good, that way you don't have to buy a plane ticket for it.
Yes.
Well, all right. I think that was a good show, and we kept it to about an hour. I want to again thank my guests, Evan Koblenz, John Leek, and Derek Warren. I look forward to having them all back on again soon, together or within a different lineup. As a repeat panelist, I'm going to try and mix it up a little bit. I apologize for how late it is in completing and posting this show. We recorded it on Saturday the 13th. Going forward, I believe I can always have the shows completed by the next day, Sunday. The next recording session is Saturday, December 4th, so that's in a little over 2 weeks. So please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and also check out my blog entries on classiccomputing.com. Plus, be on the lookout for another chapter of Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. My video podcast is being revamped, and it will be shorter from now on.
focusing primarily on my collection with a show and tell. I'm also about to release an audio interview that I did recently with a man that I acquired an Altair desk computer from. So look for that. Lots more on the way. Thanks again for listening.